I think one of the terrible memes that has been released by NPR and other places is the idea that you can infinitely pause fertility. And this is this has impacted so many women. They believe that if they get to be a working woman and they're in their 30s, 40s, and they haven't had a child, due to advances in technology, they can simply have their eggs harvested and they can be fertilized at any time and there will be no problem with that situation. They can become parents well past their 40s. As sad reality has noted, this doesn't always work out.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to Outstanding, where we have critical conversations about the news of the day and the ideas that shape us, all from a Christian worldview. I'm your host, Joseph Backholm. Our goal in every episode is to look at this crazy, crazy world where, for example, the targets of genocide are being accused of trying to commit genocide and take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. How do we interpret the facts around us? Now, there's several news stories that we're going to look at today and see if there's any kind of thread of connection. And one is an idea that you might find boring because some of us start falling asleep the moment we start hearing stats about economic data. But you shouldn't. Recent reports indicate the economic growth fell to 1.6% last quarter. Should Christians even care about a headline like that? We're going to talk about it. And something else in our country is struggling as well, and that is our fertility rate. The fertility rate fell to a record low, which has some of us really excited because they think it might lead to a reduced carbon footprint. But are there problems that are going to result from our declining fertility rate as well? And finally, what you think about things like slow economic growth and declining fertility rates is going to be significantly influenced by the source you learn about it all from. And a series of developments at National Public Radio continues to highlight the fact that a lot of news sources aren't really news sources in the sense that they're not trying to deliver the news, but they're essentially trying to shape culture and shape what people think. And why does that matter for all of us? Should we trust no one and nothing because everyone is just giving us propaganda? Well, we're going to cover that today. And joining me for the conversation is Ben Johnson, a senior reporter at The Washington Stand, who's covered all of these stories lately. Ben, good to see you today.
Good to be with you as always, Joseph.
Well, Ben, let's talk about this economic data first. Kind of the headline is 1.6% economic growth. Anything more to it than that?
Well, less than what was anticipated. So anytime that the economy falls short of expectations, that always sends shockwaves through the rest of the economy, saying that in politics and in the economy, the idea of what is anticipated really rules. So when people don't meet expectations, then people begin to panic. So it could portend negative things for the future.
Is that a headline that we as Christians should even care about? Do we care about economic growth? And I mean, economic growth is, you know, essentially how much stuff are you creating and producing in an economy, which is fine. But why ultimately is that some, is there a theological justification for being interested in that other than we kind of all want jobs and be able to pay the bills?
But it is bad enough, just the fact that we have a 1.6% economic growth last quarter. Also, that was revised downward from the previous estimate. So the revisions in the last 4 years have always tended to go downward. First, you get a positive number, then the real number comes out a little bit later. But it's also a problem because it was below expectations. And in the economy, just as in politics, expectations is key. If people see that the economy is not doing as well as they think, they begin to panic, and that sets up failure for the next economic quarter.
Now, Ben, we know that this is going to be used, this data point is going to be used as a political weapon, to be sure. We're in an election year, and ostensibly the Republicans will rejoice because the Democrats are failing. The Biden administration is failing on this, and certainly the Biden administration will spin this as not nearly as bad as the Republicans are saying it is. So we know this is going to be a political weapon. Is there a Christian or biblical way to think about economic news? Now, of course, we all want jobs, and so we want an economy to be good. But is there anything more substantively? Is there a worldview way to think about an economic news report in theological terms?
There is, just to focus on the political for just a second. I hope one thing that does come forward is the fact that we had an undeclared recession in 2022. We had, the definition of a recession is two quarters of negative economic growth, that is economic contraction that goes on for half a year. We had that in 2022, but it was never officially declared. According to the Biden administration, the metric that most people follow is two quarters of negative growth, but it officially has to be declared by a group of eight economists in the National Bureau of Economic Research called the Business Cycle Dating Committee. And they declined to label this particular contraction a recession, even though it meets all of the conditions. So we had a recession. We just don't have a declared recession.
Is that because Guido showed up with his nightstick and was beating it on his palm, saying that's a, you know, that's a nice job you have there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
What level of coercion versus collusion I cannot speak to, but there was certainly something untoward going on. But you're right. This is certainly going to be a political issue, the fact that we're not doing well, even in this this particular election year. But when you ask the most important thing, the spiritual value of this, I think that there are many, many levels to the spiritual value of the economy. First of all, you talk about employment, and this is one thing that, to his credit, President Biden has talked about quite a bit. He talks about his father losing his job. The reason they had to move from Scranton to Delaware in the first place was for better economic conditions. And he says a job is more than just a paycheck. A job gives you a sense of self-worth. A job gives you a sense of being and contribution. But spiritually speaking, what that means when you're actively employed versus being unemployed, when you're actively employed, you're using the talents that God has given you in order to serve others. In a command economy, you're doing what you're told. In an economy where we have essentially a free market, as we do in the United States, that means that other people have needs and you are acting in order to fulfill those needs. Now, those needs, of course, as we know, may be disordered, but if you're acting in a job that provides a good resource, then you're using God's talents, the talent that he has given you, in order to fulfill other people. When it comes to production, God tells us, be fruitful and multiply. Now, we can't create ex nihilo the way that God does out of nothing. We use the resources that God has given us, but we transform them. My old friend, Father Robert Sirico, always points out, when we have communion, God didn't tell us to bring grapes and grain. We bring bread and wine in imitation of Christ. So we take the elements that God has given us and refine them, make them through the work of human hands. They become something higher than what they were before. So there is a spiritual value to the economy. And when we have production, then we meet the physical needs of others as well, whether they're employed. When we have economic growth, more people can be employed, more people can be born. And if they are not experiencing this economic growth, that means that we have fewer resources in order to feed others. So it's a very important spiritual issue.
You know, that in the first couple chapters of Genesis, when God is telling us about his intentions for humanity, and this is in a perfect world, and the first two chapters of Genesis is our window into a perfect world, the things that he tells us about ourselves, he says we are created in the image of God. And one of the things we know about God is that he is a creator. And when we are created in the image of God, he creates us to also create. And in addition to that, he commanded us as a species to rule and subdue the creation that he created. So he gave us this planet with all these raw materials, and the process of ruling and subduing it means we take what God has given us and we turn it into, you know, iPhones and automobiles and skyscrapers and housing and heating units and plumbing and all of the things that make life, you know, better for us. So that actually is part of what we were created to do. So do you think it's fair to look at economic activity data as an indication of the degree to which people are actually fulfilling their created purpose? Is that a Christian way of thinking about economic growth data?
I think it absolutely is. And we understand we have a vocation from God in some sense or another to serve and to fulfill the needs of other people, to create. As you say, we're not capital C creators, but lower C creators working with the resources that God has given us. And so when people are opting out of that process, it means they're not following through on the vocation that God has given them to serve others. That's particularly concerning when you look at the economic participation rate, which has fallen in this country for years upon years, particularly starting with the Great Recession in 2008. You see a large number of what economists call NEETs. Economists like to come up with these little terms, people who are neither in education nor employment or training. NEETs. That is, they've just opted out of their future. Primarily, these are people who are receiving government benefits. They spend a lot of time in screen time and so forth, in consumption of other things, but they are not adding to the production of other resources. So when we have people who are checking out of the economy, we have to think that somehow, somewhere, we've broken down. And if you look at both the rise of people who are out of employment and training, people who are essentially hopeless in terms of their outlook, they believe that nothing they do will improve the world. And you look at the progression of secularism in our society, I don't believe the two are unrelated.
Well, there you're referring to the employment data, which is, of course, a different number than the economic growth data. They're not unrelated, but economic growth, and I'm no economist, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but economic growth basically measures how much we are producing and how much more we produce this quarter over the previous quarter. And the employment data is how many people don't have a job that want a job. And what we know, and we had David Bahnsen back on an earlier episode, and he kind of explained this well, is that the real unemployment rate in terms of able-bodied men who are not in the workforce right now mirrors the depression. But the reason our employment rate is not at an 18 or 21% level like it was in the depression is because there is a huge number of Americans who aren't even trying to find a job. So they don't show up as unemployed. So are we in a situation where people have just, quit? Are they not trying to fulfill that purpose for themselves? What do you think is the kind of right reaction to this news?
Well, you're right, and I appreciate the distinction that you're making there. When it comes to employment, you're right. The reason that it does not show up as 25% unemployment or the like, the great historic highs that we had during the Great Depression, is because unemployment only measures people who are actively seeking for a job within a certain window of time. After a few months, you fall off of that radar and you join the ranks of people who are no longer looking for a job. Now, it could be that many of those people are, in fact, looking for a job. They just can't find one. But we see these headlines saying that we've had the lowest unemployment rate in history. It's true, but it's not a complete picture. You have millions upon millions of people who are opting out of the workforce. And I think that you're asking for psychological reasons. In part, I think that people see that the jobs that are available to them are part-time. Almost 100% of the economic growth we've had over the last 4 years is part-time jobs. So they see that this is not something that's sustainable for themselves and their family. They see that there are benefits that are available in many cases that pay more than working. Particularly, you come into a certain benefits cliff where if you are receiving, for example, Medicaid other benefits, when you make a certain threshold economically, you earn a certain amount of money, then you lose your benefits. And it's not worth it for so many people because of the high cost of healthcare to work to the point that they lose their government benefits. So there's a calculation going on there. But then spiritually, even in our churches, we don't emphasize the importance of economic growth, the importance of living out our vocation to serve others that's been given to us by God. Usually we see work as drudgery based on Genesis 3. And in reality, if you look at Genesis 2, it's clear that Adam was tilling the garden when he was in the garden, but it was work that was done joyfully without thorns and thistles and so forth, but it was done joyfully in order to improve the creation that God had created under the guidance and with the direction and blessing of God. So we were talking a little bit earlier, you're talking about the GDP growth. Does that reflect something? It certainly does. I think that one of the things that you pointed to, you were talking about the growth of iPhones and so on. We have to understand there are things that make our life easier, things that make our life better. iPhone certainly is a mixed bag. Sometimes it makes your life worse. But so much of what we create when it comes to actual overall wealth, it's a measurement of wealth. And most of the technological things that you were talking about, technological progress saves lives. We take it for granted in the first world, but in the rest of the world, things like heating, things like air conditioning, for elderly Americans in this country, even air conditioning saves lives. And if you look at that progression of what we have done, economic growth goes hand in hand with technological progress, which ultimately contributes to people living longer, fuller, and more productive lives.
Yeah, the machinery that allows us to mass produce food takes people out of poverty and starvation. And the reality is the starvation problems that we have in the world, which do exist, are almost entirely political. There's plenty of food because of the economy that we have directed and our ability to mass produce things. You just live in political environments where the leadership refuses to actually help the people that they have authority over. And so the starvation problems are almost exclusively self-inflicted through bad government and just evil people in power rather than we don't have enough. And that's because we have ruled and subdued and we've innovated and we've been creative and we've been able to do those things. But Ben, I also hear an argument, even people making it right now, and I've certainly heard it before, is that, economic growth and kind of perpetual economic growth is just kind of exploitative capitalist objective. And ultimately, the planet is going to run out of resources and people are going to go extinct when we do that. So we really don't want economic growth. We want to produce less, not more, because that reduces our carbon footprint and that we use fewer resources. So Christians should honestly seek, maybe neutrality. We want everybody to have jobs and have enough to eat, but certainly not growth. What's your response to that?
Yeah, what you're talking about is something that's argued by the degrowth movement, the idea that we need to move away from economic growth and potentially even contract the economy in various ways for the long-term sustainability of the planet. I think those arguments are probably outside the purview of this particular conversation, but I don't think that they hold up. Let me say, I think that most of the things that they are saying don't in fact hold. When you look at the dire apocalyptic kind of predictions that are being made by people on the environmentalist left and so forth, they've talked about us continually running out of resources. There's the old joke that America's had zero of the 13 recessions predicted by economists. Similarly, we have run out of zero of the hundreds of bodies of commodities that we were supposed to have run through. If you go back and look at someone like Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren, who was science czar under Barack Obama and is an advisor to Joe Biden right now on science, they made massive predictions of us running out of things, of billions of people dying as a result. None of that has come to pass, and I don't believe that it will, particularly if we are wise about the way that we manage things. So I don't believe that I think that it's a problem. It's a solution in search of a problem. And ultimately, what it comes down to for Christians, God is growth focused. He tells us, be fruitful and multiply. So that's the underlying scriptural aspect of all of this that the degrowth movement would essentially undermine and replace.
Yeah. Our worldviews are defined by our assumptions about origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. Where did we come from? Who determines what's right or wrong? Who's in charge of the world? And how does that impact the way we think about economic growth and environmentalism? I want to read you a prediction from 1970 by a guy named Paul Ehrlich, who wrote this in the April 1970 issue of Mademoiselle. He said, population will inevitably and completely outstrip whatever small increases in food supplies we make. He said, the death rate will increase until at least 100 to 200 million people per year will be starving to death during the next 10 years. So he said that in 1970. So that was by 1980. We now have the benefit of hindsight to look back and say, oh, well, that wasn't true. And that's just one of a long list of predictions about kind of apocalyptic environmental impacts that didn't turn out to be true. But, and here's where I think worldview matters, because if you believe that the planet and humanity is an accident, and we are the result of random mutations, there's no design, there's no purpose, there's no intent behind our existence, Therefore, it is kind of this, you know, there's no plan. And so our survival just depends on us doing the best that we can. Then the idea that we're going to run out of resources and eventually need to flee to Mars after we have totally consumed this particular planet might make some sense. But if you assume, as you and I do, that we were actually created with a purpose and God put us on this planet for us, and that our relationship with this planet was going to help facilitate our relationship with him, and he gave this to us as a gift, and he said, rule and subdue it, and said, go have lots of babies, be fruitful and multiply. That allows us to like look at our planet in a different way. And this idea that, you know, God didn't booby trap us, right? He didn't put us on this planet so that if we discovered fossil fuel and began to burn us, it was basically we began to use fossil fuels. That was going to be a suicidal act. And he put us on this planet with very limited resources. And as soon as we use those, we were going to expire. And because I don't believe that about God, that's one of the reasons why my anxiety about like the earth warming up and destroying us all is zero or below zero, if that's possible. I just deny the premise. So do you agree with me, Ben, that what we think about how we got here has a lot to do with the way we view our relationship to the planet and whether that is one that's tenuous and about to, you know, spontaneously combust, or whether it's something that God created on purpose for us to live and exist with it for ultimately our blessing. And so it's not necessarily booby-trapped to destroy us.
You're right. What we believe ultimately affects the political reality that we embrace. So if we believe a biblical worldview, we'll ultimately enact policies that are in accordance with a biblical worldview, and we'll reap the blessings that flow from them. We know that from the scripture. We know that from human history. Contrarywise, if we adopt a secular worldview, then ultimately we see the world as a vicious struggle over resources, and ultimately we end up embracing nonsense. You've very well pointed out what Paul Ehrlich talked about in the 1980s. He talked about the great die-off, that billions of people would die over the course of the 1980s. We would have a decimated planet at this point. There was always talk of shortages, for example, that there was a belief that oil and fossil fuels were only produced by dinosaur fossils, and therefore there was a finite number of dinosaurs. Ultimately, we're going to run out of those. As it turns out, that's not the case. Fossil fuels are produced by other things as well. When it comes to the idea, for example, back in the 1980s, there was great concern that we were decimating the rainforests, and the rainforests are the only things that allow us to breathe. As it turns out, anything with chlorophyll creates oxygen. So it's not just the rainforest in one particular area. We have always thrived despite these artificial ideas that we're going to go extinct. And that ultimately derives from a worldview question that I think the one term that we can put on the phrase that you spoke so eloquently is providence. Do we believe that God is looking out for us, that he will make provision for his people, that the children of God will not go and begging bread? Or do we believe that ultimately we're on our own, an infinitesimal speck in an endless cosmos of meaninglessness, as Jean-Paul Sartre would have put it?
Yeah. A couple more failed predictions from around 1970. Dennis Hayes, the chief organizer for Earth Day, which began in 1970, he said, it is already too late to avoid mass starvation. Peter Gunter, a North Texas State University professor, also wrote in 1970 that, quote, demographers agree almost unanimously. So the science is settled. That's my parenthetical. Demographers agree almost unanimously on the following grim timetable. By 1975, widespread famines will begin in India. These will spread by 1990 to all of India, Pakistan, China, and the Near East, Africa. By the year 2000, or conceivably sooner, South and Central America will exist under famine conditions. By the year 2000, 30 years from now, the entire world, with the exception of Western Europe, North America, and Australia, will be in famine. Now, none of that actually happened, praise the Lord, because innovation happens and people have this amazing ability to solve problems. But one of the things that I think is helpful about going back and reading some of this is that the the dire predictions we hear right now have been coming for, I mean, we're now, what is that, 54 years ago that they were saying this stuff? And it just doesn't materialize because people adapt, people change, technology makes things more efficient, makes things better. But one of the related issues, and I want to get into this also with you, Ben, to kind of the environment and the economy and the way we understand the economy and people and how we weigh stewardship of the planet, which of course is a value for Christians, to be sure, but whether we value that above and beyond the needs of people, is the declining fertility rate. We have some news on that as well. What do we know?
Well, it's not good news, and it hasn't been for a very long time. There were preliminary CDC data that came out saying that the total fertility rate in the United States has hit the lowest rate in U.S. history, 1.6 children per woman. That's the 1.6 total fertility rate. Again, that's a new record-breaking low, but it's a record that we're consistently breaking. We have to remember, of course, replacement level fertility is 2.1 children because of children dying and so forth. The mother and the father have to replace themselves. So 2.1 is what we would want, which means our population is contracting in terms of the people who are being born here. We've had quite a bit of population growth, but it's all been 100% of it has been due to immigration. None of it is due to people who are born here reproducing. So we had the fewest number of babies born in 2023, according to the CDC, than we have seen since 1979. 3.6 million babies, the lowest level virtually in longer than the lives of many of our listeners. And in many cases, it is related to this idea that babies are going to strip mine the entire world of its resources, that they will be born into a terrible world, born into a fallen world. There's no question about that. But we have to understand that children are not just economic resource drainers. They're also producers. God created us with one mouth and two hands, which means that we produce far more than we end up consuming if we are willing to use our talents for God. So that ultimately is what's undermining so much of our would-be fertility growth.
And you framed that as bad news, but I know a lot of people who hear that and say, well, that's actually pretty good news. And Bill Maher actually made headlines recently for saying something that was kind of morally abhorrent about abortion. He said that, well, abortion, they say that it's murder and it kind of is, but I'm kind of okay with that. We're not going to miss you, was essentially his point. It was, yeah, we're killing people, but that's okay because we have too many people anyway. I'm paraphrasing him there. But that's essentially what he was saying. Because there is a whole, I mean, it might even be a majority of the population, I don't know that I've seen polling on this question, that think having fewer people is actually better. But Ben, what's the, what is the future if this trend continues?
Well, it's not a good one. And as you say, Bill Maher has certainly an anti-Christian worldview. We see that from his documentary, Religulous, and so forth. He is about as outspoken a secularist as you can possibly be. But he's speaking on behalf of not only a lot of Americans, but even a lot of Christians who have been misled on this issue, that ultimately population growth is going to destroy the world. The reality, we simply see that the numbers don't hold that up. In fact, the forecast, the world is already beginning to move towards shrinkage. The world's population, according to the best estimates that are out there, will peak at about 9.7 billion in 44 years. That's about 2100, let's say. And then we begin to contract almost immediately. 23 nations are going to see their populations fall by half. Japan has already peaked. It's going to lose 60% of its citizens by the year 2100. And so you're going to see this massive decrease. 1.6 is the lowest fertility rate in U.S. history, but it would be monster gargantuan growth in much of Eastern Asia. So they've already seen this to a certain degree. And the future fertility growth is very bad on a bunch of fronts. First of all, it leads to lower economic growth, worse productivity. Essentially, you're setting yourself up for deflation. You have a worker shortage. And also, when workers aren't working, as we're seeing in the United States, That leads to a smaller tax base, which means higher taxes or lower benefits or both. It threatens public health because particularly you don't have workers in sectors where you need them. When you have a much older population, you need a lot of people who are willing to work in healthcare. And if you don't have people who are working in healthcare, then you're going to have a very poor care for the individuals who are left in that situation in nursing homes and so on. Just to take the economic piece of it, which we've been talking about so much, you know, the world's second leading economy, arguably possibly the first leading economy, is China right now. And China last year posted its one of its lowest economic growth forecasts in years. We never really know what China's doing because these are communist government numbers. So we have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. But for decades, they've reported double-digit economic growth. Yep. At least 10%, often much more. Last year, the National Bureau of Statistics reported 5.2% growth. They halved it. Also, not an unrelated point, last year they lost 2 million people overall from their population. 2022 was the first year their population shrank since 1960. They lost 850,000, more than doubled that last year. And this is the exact fruit that we can see from the 40-year one-child policy that was imposed by Deng Xiaoping. For decades, they made it mandatory, and it was enforced brutally that anyone who was going to have a second child would be kidnapped and often chained to a bed and subjected to a forced abortion. They had public campaigns encouraging everyone, don't have more than one child. And now they see the economic problem here, that the population is contracting, their economy is contracting, they are facing serious repercussions for it, and they're trying to revive this and get people to have a second or a third child. And now they're no longer able to because their previous propaganda has already held. So yeah. That's just the economic piece of it. When it comes to a social welfare state, much like the United States and certainly all of Europe, you have the social welfare, essentially wealth transfer policies. For example, Social Security, Medicare, things of that sort. People who are working now pay into them. And there's sort of a bizarre idea that these are saved for us or invested or something. In reality, they go out immediately to people who are benefiting from the programs. Ultimately, when you have fewer people and a larger number of retirees, you see the percentage that Social Security is on the fast track for bankruptcy, and all of the people who are relying on it they see that we have some kind of a need to boost the amount of money that's going in there, whether that's raising the max tax or simply making a different allocation from a different pot of funds, or what I think will probably be the solution, spiritually speaking, which is we've already seen young generations rise up in their hatred of older people. And I think ultimately the solution that they're going to come to for the generation that was in favor of abortion is ultimately going to be euthanasia.
Right. You know, there's a lot there. And you mentioned kind of the problem created for the social welfare programs when people stop having children. I'm working off of memory now, but something like when Social Security was created, there were 20 payers for every recipient. And I believe now that number is down to 3-1 and could even get below that. So 3 payers for every contributor, which means you have to, those of us who are contributing a lot more, and there are fewer people supporting more people. And that is only going to continue as people can have fewer children. And you talk there about the kind of one-child policy that existed by government fiat in China. But we've essentially adopted that for ourselves by choice, and largely because a lot of people, and when you do survey data on this question, there are a lot of, you know, 20-something, 30-somethings right now who could be having children that have made the choice that we're not going to have children because it's bad for the environment. And there, we just think the planet's about to blow up and end. And I'm having fun going through this list, but I'm going to go back to a couple other predictions from 1970. You know, we've seen lots of recent examples about how, you know, the so-called experts have gotten things wildly and almost comically wrong. But here's some other, you know, hindsight stuff that we can look at. Life magazine from January of 1970, and that, of course, was the experts in the 1970s, quote, "Scientists have solid experimental and theoretical evidence to support the following predictions. In a decade, urban dwellers will have to wear gas masks to survive air pollution. By 1985, air pollution will have reduced the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth by one half." End quote. In the same article, ecologist Kenneth Watt told Time magazine that, quote, "At the present rate of nitrogen buildup, it's only a matter of time before light will be filtered out of the atmosphere and none of our land will be usable," end quote. Here we are 54 years later, and wouldn't you know it, at least some of our land, Ben, appears to still be usable. And so that's what Time magazine was telling us in 1970. We know they got this wildly wrong, but it influenced a lot the way a lot of people thought, but it, at least at that point, it didn't reduce the number of children we were having. What I want to get into now is the way in which our beliefs about the world and the way we're responding to it by choosing not to have children are influenced by the people we're getting this information from. And National Public Radio has kind of been front and center for the last couple of weeks in the argument or illustration of how bad so many of our information sources are. Ben, catch us up on what's going on at NPR.
Well, NPR, of course, A, it still exists, which is maybe news to some people, but NPR, right now they have a new CEO, Catherine Marr. I believe her name is pronounced Marr, but Catherine Marr, formerly with the Wikipedia Foundation, and our friend Chris Rufo over at the Manhattan Institute went through all of her tweets from years past. He found some that were comical almost in the way that they're expressed, but in many cases they're concerning. For example, when she talks about people threatening to leave the country, she says that she will stay here in part because she has, and this is a quote, cis white mobility privilege. Cis, of course, standing for cisgender. So she's obviously drinking deeply from the well of gender ideology. During the 2016 election, she kind of tweaked Hillary Clinton. She posted on Twitter, "I do wish Hillary wouldn't use the language of boy and girl. It's erasing language for non-binary people." And I think all of it really flows from her worldview. She gave a TED talk at the time where when she was at the Wikipedia Foundation, she said there are many different truths. We all have different truths. So when you're relying on NPR for factual information, remember that the truth they're reporting may not be the actual truth or align with truth as we know it.
And they had a now former employee. His name is Yuri, I think, Berliner. Do I have that name right? Am I making that
right?
Up?
Berliner, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who had essentially wrote an article saying that this news outlet that I've worked at for 25 years is basically run hard to the left. And he was willing to talk about the fact that he didn't feel that they were actually interested in objective information. They just kind of become part of the left's mouthpiece. And he thought that was a problem for a place that really should just be delivering news. The company's response to that has made him now a former employer of NPR. How much of what we've talked about with the way we view economic data and the way we view babies and people and humans' relationship to the earth, how much of that is influenced by just news outlets and media outlets that really just want to make us afraid of destroying the planet?
I think a great deal of it is influenced that way. So many of these stories are coming from people who hold a secular worldview, who hold to the ideologies that we've talked about on this program, so many of them premised upon faltering or false ideologies and predictions that never came to pass, as so many of that you just cited. And so the headlines sort of proceed from that worldview. They take the erroneous information for granted and then base stories based on that. So I think that a lot of this comes from that. For example, when Berliner was talking about the newsroom in Washington, D.C. at the public radio station there, he said there were 87 employees, particularly in editorial capacity, but 87 employees, all of them were Democrats. Not a single one was a Republican. Being a Republican, of course, is not necessarily consistent with being a Christian. So we're talking about a different subset altogether. For the most part, the Democratic Party tends to be far more secular. The people who work at NPR certainly tend to be far more secular. And so that's influencing and ultimately shaping their news coverage. There's no question about it. In fact, it's codified in their guidance. In 2019, they put out a guidance reminder saying that, and this is a, forgive the longer quotation here, but it says, quote, quote unquote, the term unborn implies there is a baby inside a pregnant woman, not a fetus. Babies are not babies until they're born. They're fetuses. Incorrectly calling a fetus a baby or the unborn is part of the strategy used by anti-abortion groups to shift language slash legality slash public opinion. So ratifying science, saying that an unborn child is an unborn child because according to science, life begins at the moment of fertilization or conception, and the Bible certainly holds to that scientific view as well, is in fact somehow trying to change the political dynamics of the world around us. I think one of the terrible memes that has been released by NPR and other places is the idea that you can infinitely pause fertility. And this is this has impacted so many women. They believe that if they get to be a working woman and they're in their 30s, 40s, and they haven't had a child, due to advances in technology, they can simply have their eggs harvested and they can be fertilized at any time and there will be no problem with that situation. They can become parents well past their 40s. As sad reality has noted, this doesn't always work out. The technology that's been promised does not always yield the results that have been promised by many outlets, including NPR. In fact, there was a heartbreaking story back during the Great Recession that some researchers from Princeton had researched exactly how many women had put off fertility and ultimately were going to miss their window because of putting it off so long. They found 151,082 American women who wanted to have children will never have children because they waited too long. So that's a very important aspect of the information that we're getting shapes our worldview, it shapes our actions, and ultimately it ends up contributing negatively to people who want to have children and they're never going to be able to.
You know, one of the challenges about all this, Ben, when we talk about the, you know, bad predictions from the 1970s about climate doom, and, you know, more recently, bad predictions about all sorts of things related to, you know, COVID and vaccines and just the fact that we cannot, quote unquote, trust the science. What we also know is science is a great thing and it's tools to teach us things about the universe and about the world that God created. And when we have that knowledge, we can help cure diseases and relieve pain and make life more comfortable and, you know, lift people out of poverty. And there's lots of wonderful things that result from studying the world and understanding the rules of nature that the creator of nature created for it. And all of that is worthwhile, which is part of the reason. I mean, the fact that science ever existed was because there were initially a bunch of Christians who were like, well, a lawgiver created this world, therefore there must be laws. Let's go find out what those things are. So science is a wonderful thing and a worthy pursuit. But how do we know? How do we not become so cynical? And how do we know when the information that science is giving us is actually reliable and worth kind of internalizing and acting on, as opposed to when we're probably being manipulated by people with an agenda, at least an agenda, or maybe just bad assumptions about the nature of reality? And I think a lot of the climate doom stuff that, you know, I don't think God just created the earth to kill us with, so there's some assumptions there. But how do we know when we are being played? Because none of us are personally experts. I'm not a scientist. To my knowledge, you're not a scientist in that sense. We don't spend all of our days in a lab. And we want to be able to trust that people have good intentions and good information, that when they deliver it to us, it's going to be in our best interest to act on that. How do we know?
Yeah, ultimately, you're asking quid est veritas, right? What is truth? Question that was posed so many times in so many places. And it's so difficult for us in when it comes to the sort of fog that hangs over the news to be able to pierce through and know what is the truth, because we hear so many competing narratives, much of it based on narrative. For those of us, particularly when it comes to scientific questions, you're right, I'm not a scientist. We're not scientists together. We have to rely on those who are. As you say, it was placed, science came forward from a desire to understand God's laws. And so I think for until someone comes forward and tells us what the shortfalls are of these studies, and we have to keep, first of all, an open mind when we hear anything telling us about science, to look for competing voices and to make up our mind to the greatest extent that we can based on the full picture that emerges before us. But as you say, we cannot just simply blindly trust officials that they have our best interest in mind, or even that what they're talking about is based on solid scientific reality, as we found out during the recent unpleasantness in 2020. So, but these things generally, I would say there is one golden thread that runs through all of this, which is no bona fide scientific reality will ever contradict God's law. If we understand God and His word, it can never be contradicted by His creation. So, for example, during COVID, there were concerns about population growth and so on and so forth. There was a study that came out of San Pablo University in Madrid. They found that the lower population, as I say, Spain had a very low fertility rate. They found that the fact that the population had shrunk in Spain actually spread COVID, both as a percentage of society, obviously, because the more people who die, the smaller the society. When one person dies, it's a higher percentage than a large society. But also they found that so many people had died, elderly people were dying unnecessarily, because traditionally in Spain, it's a very family-based culture, people lived in multi-generational families. The elderly lived with their children or grandchildren or both. But because of the fact that there were so many fewer children who were born over the years, there was a 550% increase in elderly people living alone since 1976. When people live alone, you have higher mortality rates. And since they couldn't dependably live by themselves, they were transferred to a care institution with other elderly people where they spread COVID to one another, and that increased the mortality rate, because that's the bullseye for COVID mortality. So ultimately, when God says, be fruitful and multiply, trust in me, I providentially will care for you, it will be to our own physical good as well as to the spiritual good of everyone around us if we follow God's word.
God tells us to be fruitful and multiply, and He tells us that our children are a blessing, and somehow we have convinced ourselves that our children will kill us if they exist. And if not kill us, they will destroy our happiness. And we see kind of the supernatural war on just everything that God said is good. But it's interesting, as we kind of wrap up this conversation, if we understand the way God has created the world, that and what He has said us about, told us about Himself, that He is good, that He created the world, He declared it to be good, and He did it for our best intentions, then we can be optimistic about the planet that He put us on and the future that we have on it, and not fear that ruling and subduing and creating and doing the things God created us for is somehow going to be the death of us. But the other things that God told us about ourselves and about the problem of the world is that we're all corruptible, and we all struggle with a sin problem, which allows us to consume media and information and talking points with a healthy skepticism, recognizing that our motives are not necessarily pure. And just because somebody smart has a degree does not mean that they are free of agendas and biases, and nor are we, right? So we consume that information with a healthy skepticism, recognizing that anybody could be lying to us at any point for any reason. So hopefully we will be sober-minded and not easily deceived by whatever wind of doctrine is currently floating around the internet. So, Ben, thanks for your time today. This has been a fun conversation. And, population, the economy, all of these things, ultimately it does, we will be more joyful. And I think just better livers of the life God gave us, if that's a way to say that, if we just remember the things that are ultimately true. So thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate you addressing these issues. These are issues that so often we don't think of as faith issues. And as we understand, all things are in God's hands. There is not a single square inch of this world that God does not look at and say, this is mine. So I appreciate you for breathing this spiritual truth into these issues. Thank you so much, Joseph.
That's what we try to do every day. And we think it's outstanding. Thanks a lot, man. And thank you, friends, for joining us today. If you have any questions, comments about this, email me at outstanding@washingtonstand.org. I do love to hear from you about the shows and the programs and the conversation we're having. I especially love the recommendations for future topics, things that you're working through that we could help wrestle through with you. Also, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you found us. Give us a 5-star review if you would, because that helps us make new friends for the program. I've enjoyed the time. Once again, look forward to next time. Every Tuesday and Friday, the new episode come. My name is Joseph Backholm, and this has been Outstanding.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.